Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Zimmerman with Becker's Healthcare. Thank you for tuning into the Becker's Healthcare podcast. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by our guest as we discuss a study on neonatal outcomes after uterus transplantation. Before we begin, I want to introduce our speakers. So Jackie York, MD, the neonatologist at Pediatrics Medical Group, a Mednax company, and Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas. Lisa Johannesson, MD, gynecological surgeon at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas. Dr. York and Dr. Johannesson, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so before we get into the study findings here, I'm wondering if Dr. York, you can tell us a little bit about Pediatrics Neonatology Program at Baylor.
Yes, the Pediatrics Neonatology Program at Baylor, Baylor University Medical Center, is a level four NICU. A level four NICU is provides the highest level of care for our most tiny, critically ill infants, and provides 24-hour coverage with the neonatologist in-house, and provides surgical services if needed, therapeutic hypothermia, high-frequency ventilation, to take care of the sickest of our little babies.
Well, thank you for setting the stage there, Dr. York. And Dr. Johannesson and Dr. York, I'd love it if you both could weigh in on this next one, but just looking for a brief overview of the study and what you both found.
Yeah, so if I can start. So the uterus transplant study in Dallas started in 2016, and it actually grew into the world's largest uterus transplant program over the years. So we have now transplanted 21 women, and we have been very fortunate to deliver 14 babies so far. And Dr. York has been taking care of all these neonates after their birth. And I think the main finding that I want to share is that these babies are actually like any babies. I don't know, Dr. York, if you want to add something there. We haven't seen any issues with these babies that we don't see in normally developed babies.
And I totally agree with Dr. Johannesson. These babies, one of our biggest concerns is with these infants who were exposed to immunosuppressive therapy, obviously have had other types of solid organ transplantations, and there were some concerns with that in regards to preterm labor or growth restriction. But we added on with this uterine transplant a change in the vascular anatomy from a transplanted uterus, which is different from a native uterus, which there could be some concerns for the nutritional demands of the fetus. So we wanted to make sure that these babies were doing okay. And this study is the first of its kind to really report on neonatal outcomes. It's by far the largest experience from a single center. And I agree with Dr. Johannesson. These babies did great. They experienced normal growth. We did perform several labs on these infants just to make sure that they weren't at increased risk of infection. We did not see that with these infants. And of most importance, these little ones at 2 months are thriving. They're meeting their developmental milestones and their behavioral milestones. So we're very pleased with how these little ones are doing. That felt like that it was neat in the literature to show how these infants were doing from a large transplant service.
That's really wonderful to hear, especially thinking about them thriving a couple months later. That's just got to be so gratifying. I'm curious if you can talk about how this study sort of is different than others that have been done before. What makes this study stand out?
Well, I think what makes it different, you know, this is a very novel field. Uterus transplantation, the first baby ever born in the world was in 2014. So you can see it's a very, very new field in general. So the biggest difference with this study was that we had the numbers. So before us, there's been sporadic cases in countries all over the world, but we were able to have aggregated data on these outcomes on these babies. And we are actually the first ones that publish this data. So I think that is the most important thing here, that we need to get out with it with large data groups, large populations, to see how these babies actually are doing. And that's what kind of sticks out with this study.
Thank you so much, Dr. Johannesson, for sharing that. Dr. York, did you have anything to add here as well about what sort of makes this study stand out?
Just the description of each of the 12 infants in regards to not only as the group, in regards to not seeing any growth restriction or specific problems, but we also described the hospital course for each of these 12 infants, which is interesting as well.
Thank you. And Dr. York, staying with you for this next question. So, can you talk a bit more about sort of the hospital course of care for these infants? How were they cared for and observed? Can you share some more details there?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, five of the 12 did not even require any NICU hospitalization at all. They stayed with their mothers. They were discharged with their mothers at day of life three. 7 of these little ones did require varying degrees of NICU intervention and stay with us in the neonatal intensive care unit, and for varying reasons. One infant was born at 33 weeks prematurely. The mom had had some acute kidney injury, so the infant did need to be delivered early. There were 2 that were delivered due to preterm labor in the mothers, one at 36/7 weeks and the other one at 32 4/7 weeks. And they had the typical premature course that you would think of at those gestational ages. There were really no significant surprises with them. The others were a 35-weeker, 35 6/7 week. Mom did have some gestational diabetes. The baby exhibited some very mild respiratory distress, which would not be a surprise for a baby that was born as late preterm, especially of an infant of a diabetic mother. And this infant still went home a day of life 7, which is really good for that age of a baby. There was one infant that was born at 37 2/7 weeks that had some hypoglycemia and came to the NICU for some IV dextrose infusion, but was still discharged by day of life 6. Another 37 0/7 week infant that exhibited some transient tachypnea of newborn. But it's not uncommon for us to see a baby who's born by C-section without a trial of labor, without having that stimulus of hormonal stimulus for the infant to stop making so much fetal lung fluid, typically about 25 cc's per kilo per day. Once they get that stimulus, they'll cut that down to about 4 cc's per kilo per day. They don't get that signal without, with a planned C-section. Plus, they don't have that vaginal squeeze to get rid of some of that fluid. So this baby did exhibit some transient tachypnea of newborn, but still roomed off nasal cannula by day of life 1 and went home rather quickly. And the last one that came to the NICU was another 35-week infant that had some initial periodic breathing that was noted soon after delivery. And a result was monitored in the NICU for a short time and ended up going home and not requiring any further evaluation or treatment and discharged with mom on day of life 3. So these infants did fantastic. Again, I wanted to mention that we did not see any significant growth retardation in these infants. We had a mean gestational age of 36 6/7 weeks. We had a mean birth weight of 29-20 grams. So these infants did very well.
Thank you, Dr. York. Important to share that clinical context for our listeners out there. And I want to zoom out here with this next question, Dr. Johannesson, which is, what are the implications of this for the hundreds of thousands of women suffering from infertility? And I'm sure so many of our listeners, whether it's personal experience with this issue or whether they have someone close to them who's struggled with it. It's a really painful experience. So I think this is a really important point to speak to.
Yeah. So the patients we have is suffering from infertility, and infertility is a very severe diagnosis. It affects all aspects of life. And the last hurdle of infertility that we haven't been able to treat prior to this was if you are lacking a uterus or you're lacking a functional uterus. And that actually affects thousands and thousands of women. Some are born without uterus, some lose their uterus in cancer diagnosis or after giving birth in peripartum bleedings or due to fibromas that we can't take away. So there's many, many women out there that want to conceive, that want to carry a pregnancy, that haven't been able to do that, even with the advances we have done so far in infertility. And up until very recently, the options for these women and couples was to either use a gestational surrogacy where that is legal. And we can say also that it's legal in most of the states in the US, but in most of the European countries, for example, it's illegal to use gestational surrogacy. Or they could go through adoption. Both of those alternatives might be really, really good for some women and couples, but some also want to experience gestation and to give birth themselves. And for these women, this study is very, very important because for the first time, we can say not only that we can reproduce and we can be successful and deliver babies, but we can also deliver healthy babies. And these babies are expected to have the same outcome as if you didn't have uterus transplantation. So it means that if we have a teenager that comes into the doctor for the first time because she didn't get her period, we can give her options if she lacks a uterus. We can say, well, this is a devastating moment for you in time, because we're telling you that you don't have a uterus, but there are options for you. You can either do adoption, you can do gestational surrogacy, or you can even carry a pregnancy and give birth if you go undergo a uterus transplantation. So I think this study, what it adds to the world literature, is very, very important.
Absolutely. You know, thinking about that, another option, another path forward. So thank you so much for that, Dr. Johannesson. To close here, I'm wondering if you can both just sort of share a bit about, you know, what does this look like then for the future of uterus transplantation? Are there additional studies in the works? Any details you can share there about how this is going to affect, you know, procedure evolves in the future?
I think from the neonatal end, it will be to continue to follow these infants, you know, see how they're doing. Some of these infants are over a year now, to see how they're doing more long term. I'm not anticipating any problems, but I think it's important to continue to follow them.
That is, I completely agree. And we will probably follow these babies until they graduate college, just to make sure that they're doing great and that they're doing that like their peers. And if you look at the kind of development of uterus transplantation, there are several centers in the US and internationally that's starting up. And this study that we present today with the neonatal follow-up is very encouraging for these programs, because they can also tell their patients now that this study is ongoing and this is a safe procedure that is safe for the recipient, the donor, and the child that comes. So if you just look in the US, we have now three active programs, with one other one, the fourth one, starting in next coming weeks. And internationally, there's about 20 programs that does uterus transplantation. It's continuously growing. So I think in the future, we will see this more and more common.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. York and Dr. Johannesson, for taking the time out of your days to share that exciting news with us and our audience. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I also want to thank our podcast sponsor, MedNex. You can tune into more podcasts from Becker's Healthcare by visiting our podcast page at beckershospitalreview.com/podcast.